Okay, let's go. Let me do a little clap here for these cameras. Welcome back to the Storytelling for Social Impact podcast. It's the podcast where we share tips and insights from our guests' years of experience on how to tell stories that can make a positive impact in the world. I always ask each guest about their SDG as well, and together we dive into a conversation that's hopefully really helpful in inspiring you, encouraging you, and helping to educate you on better ways to tell stories that can affect social change. Today, I had an amazing guest. His name was Liam Black. I've known him for a long time. The thing that I love about him the most is he's not afraid to speak his mind. He is a contrarian of sorts, that we respect and remember our unique role as change makers, that sometimes we have to rock the boat a little bit, if you like, to be able to affect that change. We had a great conversation today. We also looked at the importance of being profitable. We looked at the importance of learning from great guides who brought wholly different perspectives and experience that really benefited him. He talks about how he's then often playing that role for others as well. We talked about the power of storytelling in business, in your own personal story, like taking authorship, if you like, and responsibility for telling your own story and how you'll be remembered, and the power of story, if you like, to bring people on the journey with you. So please do dive in and enjoy the episode, and I'll see you on the other side. Hey, Liam, good to see you after a while.
Yeah, lovely to see you. We're both grey-bearded now.
We are.
What happened? What happened to the bright young things? Mind you're still a baby, aren't you?
Well, it's all relative, isn't it? It's like funny when my parents got into their 70s. Like, of course, 70 was not old, but but it just keeps shifting, doesn't it? What's still young?
Well, I'm God Almighty. I'm nearly 65 now, but I'll be 65. On my next birthday, and I'm a sort of granddad now for the last 10 years.
Oh, that's exciting.
It's very exciting. And I have to say, you know, thank God I'm healthy. I'm still married to the same woman.
Yeah. You're doing well.
I think I'm doing all right. I think I've come to terms, but I'm happy in this old skin.
Yeah.
Even though I'd like a bit more hair and, you know.
Yeah.
I look like this, but
no,
but hopefully there's a bit of life left in the old dog yet.
Absolutely, and lots of experience and stories to pass on to the next generations as well, which is good. An interesting life.
Yeah, that's better than saying an old boar who talks about the past all the time. Thank you for framing it like that.
Yeah. So one of the things that I have always appreciated about you is I met you many years back, probably going back now 15 years ago, around Good Deals conference with Tim West, yeah. You know, the social enterprise stuff, Oxford Jam, of course, those were great days.
Oh, yeah, they were.
And I always appreciated that you were not afraid to speak your mind, that you were... I think you probably enjoyed it a bit, like you were a bit contentious to get people thinking.
I love it.
But I always appreciated that, because sometimes there, in any industry or any sort of majority group, it can all become a bit homogenous and a bit sort of a company line, and it happens in every sphere. Yeah. And so it's always interesting and exciting to have someone stirred up a little bit.
I've always been wary of groupthink, and I've always been wary, I don't know who said it, but you know, when everyone is agreeing, if everyone thinks the same in a room, no one's thinking.
Well, that's good point.
I've always been a bit like that. And when I first started with Tim West, actually writing in, you know, Social Enterprise magazine, which he got going, I mean, years ago, well over 20 years ago now. And I had that column, Dear Jude, you know, letters to a young social entrepreneur. And I always thought, you know, I'm not really a strategic thinker. I am a shallow, as I sound a lot of the time. I genuinely am. And I thought, if I've got a platform, I'm going to use that voice for social entrepreneurs at the grassroots. Actually, people trying to do this very difficult thing of create businesses that are going to achieve verifiable, positive social impact. And the best thing I could do is to say out loud what I know everyone is really thinking, And yeah. I could say it because FRC by that time was a self-funding, profitable, cash generative social enterprise. And we couldn't have anyone threatening us with, you know, withdrawing our grant funding or not inviting us along to things. And that's what I did. So that played nicely into what I thought was needed at the time. And also my, I like speaking out and I don't like being part of a groupthink or part of the herd.
Yeah, definitely. And it just, you touched on something important there about funding. So it's, you know, oftentimes there are reasons why many people are part of the groupthink because potentially their livelihoods, etc., depend on staying within that framework. Whereas when you have that luxury, if you like, or benefit of being independent financially, you can say what you like. And it's actually interesting. I just to tell you a quick story. When we were starting out, I started Be Inspired Films in 2008, and I'd heard about the idea of social enterprise, and I was excited about it because it was like, instead of being dependent on funding, you know, I'd heard funding to fail, short-term funding, charity funding, you're always chasing the next one, that if you could stand on your own legs and you could deliver this social impact, wouldn't that be so great? So I thought, that sounds brilliant. But the bit about it was, you obviously then it curtailed what you could do with the profits and stuff. So I knew that we wanted to have certain values and we wanted to trade on our own feet, which we did. And it was really important to me because I didn't want to be beholden to anyone. But interestingly, it wasn't until the B Corporation movement came along later that actually I found a model that sort of fitted better for us, because with the social enterprise model, I saw, unfortunately, so many of them were still dependent on funding, and it didn't really live up to
its... Too much social, not enough enterprise.
Yeah, it didn't live up to its promise. As you say, apart from some of the big ones like FRC, what was FRC stand for?
Furniture Resource Centre. So it began in 1988 as a very traditional secondhand furniture charity, get some money from charitable trusts or a bit of cash off the council, run a unreliable minibus around Liverpool, pick up furniture, give it away until, you know, you didn't have any anymore. And that's around until that 1988. So a few years after that, the early 90s, I was working for Crisis, the homelessness charity, and we had more money than we could give away. So the trustee said, go and look for some good things that we could give money to that have got scale and have the possibility to be able to become financially independent if with the money. So I met Robbie Davison and Nick Francis, the two founders of FRC, handed over 180 grand, which would be a lot of money today. That was a lot of money in the
huge amount,
early 90s.
Yeah.
And went on the board to sort of keep an eye on them, fell in love with the organization, and then was part of what would become a sort of reinvention of the organization and making all sorts of mistakes. But we got there, and 21 years after I left, FRC is still going, it's turning over 20 million plus, it's profitable,
fantastic,
and it's doing great work and continuing to employ lots of people in Liverpool and get furniture into the homes of thousands and thousands of people as part of its mission to end furniture poverty. So it was, for me, a time of immense challenge, anxiety, joy, and a real formation for me in my understanding of what a purpose-led business is. And I took over in 97. I was the chair for a couple of years, then took over as the CEO, and then was involved in the real sort of evolution of it. It was Trust, Co-op Bank kept us going for a couple of years with an overdraft. Thank you, Co-op Bank. But eventually the lines crossed and we became profitable. And we ended up having lots of cash in the bank, which allowed us to innovate. So we created Bulky Bobs, which was a recycling business that lasted for 20 years, a partnership with the City Council, and the Cat's Pajamas, where we drew hundreds of people from all over the world to come and look at what we're doing. So, yeah, I sort of lived that journey and was some of the best 10 years of my life, actually.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I know as you've gone on, you know, you've had a passion for sharing what you learned with other social entrepreneurs coming up. You'd often speak at events, but and you wrote that great book, The A to Z of Social Entrepreneurship, was it?
The Social Entrepreneur's A to Z on Leadership, Anxiety, and Getting Enough Sleep.
Yes, I knew there was something about getting sleep. But also in there, I remember very clearly one of the things was, you know, you've got to be profitable and not shying away from talking about money, because I think sometimes those of us that are in the kind of, social impact space or whatever, sometimes if we examine ourselves, there's sometimes a bit of an allergy to money in a way, or, not necessarily the certain views or beliefs around money. And I think in terms of sustainability, of course, financial sustainability is also really important, right?
Oh, well, it's vital. If you don't have financial sustainability, what have you got? So when we were reinventing FRC back in the sort of early 90s, profit was a really dirty word amongst lots of people in the, whatever you want to call it, the non-profit sector, the voluntary sector. Mm. I mean, I used to do this thing, again, a bit provocative, where if I was giving a talk, I would get everyone to stand up in the room and I'd say, breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth. And I guess people thought I was going to do some yoga or something. And then I would say, okay, say after me, profit is good. And you could see people like, what the fuck is he talking about? And then you have, like, three quarters of the room would be like,
arms crossed.
A few people would be like this. And some people got very, very angry with me and would, I was in Newcastle or some northeast somewhere, and someone threw a shoe at me.
Really?
It was so angry that I would dare to do that. And I guess where that came from was a belief that profit was the preserve of the dirty private sector, and you could only make a profit if you're screwing someone. And as I would point out to people, well, you don't have to screw anyone to make profit. No. Some people do, but many, many businesses don't.
Yeah.
And you're getting this free money from foundations where they get their money from investments from that dirty private sector. And you only have that money because somewhere somebody has made a profit and passed that on through their taxes or whatever it might be. I think that has gone away. I mean, I think you would get less of that. And there's obviously been the rise of impact investing and the B Corp and all of that in that time. But it was an enormous, strong cultural belief, which divided lots of people in Liverpool. Lots of people in Liverpool hated FRC. Yeah. We were seen as sort of apostates for going down this room and mimicking the private sector, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And we just thought, well, I don't think so. Let's just stay focused on our mission, which is to create meaningful employment for people in a city desperate for it, and to get as much furniture as we can into the homes of single mums and women escaping domestic violence and poor families and refugee families. And we did that at a scale which we simply would not have been able to do if we had remained reliant on what we used to call the kindness of strangers.
Yeah.
So I make no apology for it. And the fact that FRC is still there, profitable, lots of money in the bank, doing great work, when lots of the critics are long gone.
Yes.
And some of the other sort of, poster children of the social enterprise movement from that era are gone.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I've always been a believer of that as well, of taking the best from different places and bringing them together. We always ask every guest, what is an SDG that is close to your heart? What's yours?
Well, can I don't tell anyone, Rav, but I've got a little confession to make. Don't tell anyone. I mean, in preparation for that question today, I've actually looked at the SDGs in some detail for the very first time, and discovered there are a lot of them, aren't there?
There are. They're very colourful as well.
And then very colourful. Some designer made some good money there, putting all that together. So I would say the one that resonated with me was the one about inequality. Mm. I've done lots of different things in my career up until today. And I think the one thread that, through recycling, retail, hospitality, leadership development, mental health, all of the stuff that I've been involved in and continue to be involved in, the thread through all of that, I think, is a desire to try and make society a bit more equal, whether that's an access to healthcare or furniture or income. And that, I guess, comes out of my own, background as the son of Irish working class immigrants growing up in the 70s and wanting to do it. And that's very strong in me. So I would say equality, and particularly wealth inequality and health inequality, are the ones that really still speak to me.
Yeah, no, I can see that. You mentioned FRC becoming very profitable. In the beginning, did you also get some grant funding? What I'm curious about is that the different times in the journey, different types of funding are appropriate, right? It's not just one size fits all kind of thing.
Yeah, and you know, I never get ideological about any of this stuff. It's kind of, for me, it's like horses for courses. If you can do it, if you can free yourself from the dependence upon free money, if you can do that, do it. If you can't do it because there's no market for what you do, you are working with, you know, you're in a place where it just doesn't work like that, that's absolutely fine as well. And so we, you know, because we were a charity, we couldn't get investment. So we had to get free money. So we raised money from the Esme Fairbairn Foundation and lots of other foundations and said, look, this is what we're going for. And if you give us this money, you'll never see us again, either because it will have worked and we don't need you, or it won't have worked and we'll be so ashamed we'll never go to Lime Street and leave Liverpool ever again. So we were very explicit about that. And that also with the money from Crisis, the 180 grand that I mentioned. So that's where that capital came from to lease the vehicles, get the warehouse.
Gave you a foundation, kind of, yeah.
Get the forklift trucks, get all of that stuff that we needed in order to launch Furnished Homes, which was the service that drove the mission, the impact and the profitability of the company. So, yeah, if you can get free money, why would you not get free money? You know, some of the business I'm involved in at the moment, if someone was willing to give us 180 grand, that'd be great. You know, not ideological at all about it. But our desire to break free of that sort of gravitational pull did piss a lot of people off. And our success, I think, was sort of a good example that a lot of politicians urged them to mimic or copy. And some could and didn't. Some couldn't and didn't, which was good. And some just didn't like the whole idea. And to be frank, didn't like me very much. And I can understand that. I'm a bit Marmite. And I've come to terms with that, Rav, with my therapist. So it was a great example. And we created the Cat's Pajamas on the back of that. Lots of people came to see us.
Was that like a training program or what was that?
Yeah, we would. I mean, honest to God, the thing that triggered it was people would come to Liverpool to have a look at us and would just turn up. And I remember one day, no word of a lie, a bloody coach turned up from Yorkshire somewhere with a whole load of sort of community activists on it, pulled up outside and said, can we have a look round?
Wow.
And it was like, well, no, you can't have a look round because I'm sure we could have a look round. And so we thought, you know, what we were doing was attracting a lot of attention as we began to scale and talk more about what we were doing. And so we said, okay, the first Thursday of every month, come and have a look. And depending who was around, if it was me, you got me. If it was a receptionist, you got Jill or one of the other brilliant women that worked there. You might have got Sean, you might have got whoever. Yeah. And then we thought, well, maybe there's a business here. And then particularly as, you know, Labour getting elected in 97 and there being lots of talk about social entrepreneurship and so on, myself and Jeremy Nichols, who at that time was running Urban Strategy Associates, a regeneration company in the city, we'd become mates. And we thought, why don't we do something where you come and have a proper look at what we're doing and the work of Blackburn House and some other places. And so we thought, okay, what should we call it? And, you know, we could have called it the, you know, Merseyside Social Entrepreneurship Study Tour thing. And we thought, no, let's not do that. Let's make it a bit sexier than that. So we were going to call it the Dog's Bollocks. Well, we were going to call it the Dog's Bollocks.
Maybe a little too far, possibly.
Maybe that's probably too much. And then I got a text one night from Sarah, Jeremy's partner at the time and now his wife. And she said, I'm watching this black and white thriller. Yeah. It's kind of 1940s American gangster thing. Yeah. And someone has just said in it, praising something, do you know what? That's the Cat's Pajamas. I'd heard of the Bee's Knees and all of that. And so the next day, Jeremy and I went, Cat's Pajamas. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah. That would brand very well. So it became the cat's pajamas. We bought half a page in the Guardian Society newspaper.
Remember that,
that, which was read by everybody in the sort of non-profit world in the UK at the time. And we said something like, come to Liverpool and get inside 200 years experience with seven organizations, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And we didn't have anything organized. We just put it in the paper and thought, let's see. And then I remember Anne-Marie Grimesy, she was affectionately called, coming into my office and saying, God, Jesus, we've had loads of response to that thing. We better organize something. So we did. And we ran the first one. It was a three-dayer, you know, visits, panels, after dinner speeches, all of that. Worked really, really well. And then we ended up running loads of them and then one-day masterclasses. And then we went overseas and we did Top Cat in the States.
Oh, yeah.
And we did Big Cat in South Africa.
Okay.
And we had all sorts of other things planned. We were going to do one looking at cities in Europe that had been poor ports that were developing, like Liverpool, Barcelona. That was going to be called Ship's Cat.
Okay.
And there were some others. So we had good fun with it. But the whole gist of it was to enable people to come and have and systematically engage with our business models, what we were learning, and get access to, you know, the drivers, the upholsterers, the finance people, to ask whatever they wanted. And as I say, we had hundreds of people. And every couple of months, maybe, still 20 years later, more, I get people who come up to me and go, I came on one of your Cat's Pajamas events, and it was brilliant. And I left my job, or I changed the organization, or whatever they did. I don't hear from the people who left their job and it was a disaster, or they crashed their organization. They must be out there fuming at me and Cat's Pajamas. But generally, it was a really positive, enjoyable, useful exercise, I think. And we were real pioneers in it. This was before you know, any organization was doing that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I think the whole approach of it was very much led from a ground up kind of thinking, right, rather than too theoretical, or, you know, it was very much really rooted in the realism of doing it, right?
Yeah, Jeremy likes a good theory. So he would... he do some of that brilliantly well, particularly around impact and impact assessment. But the idea was that just come and see for yourself. So if you're thinking of creating your own social enterprise, or you want to transform your culture in the way that we were, come and see what that really means.
Yeah.
And also at the end of those 3 days, if people said, you know what, I'm not doing this because we culturally couldn't do that. That was a great outcome for us, because the last thing we wanted was loads of people being encouraged by the government or whoever to set up social enterprises and failing because they just didn't have the culture, the resources, the market in order to do it.
And that's interesting, isn't it? How, and it happens many times in history over and over and over, where something comes along that's sort of positioned as, you know, the next thing, or the next answer to whatever. And it's very easy to sort of just go along with it and try and copy and paste, you know, without necessarily seeing what's right, or if it really is the right thing, right?
Oh, completely. And then what happened was then whole industry emerged, you know, a sort of PR industry, Skoll and Aspen and Social Enterprise UK and Unlimited and all of that, where there's a sort of cadre of people who's, you know, who are the propagandists for this movement and are wanting content all the time, you know, speakers and award ceremonies and all of that, and often don't do enough due diligence on what the organizations they're promoting. How many times, I mean, this is again going back, I'm not invited to these things anymore, but, you know, how many times I would go to a social enterprise award ceremony and go, you've given that social entrepreneur social enterprise of the year, I know they've got about 10 minutes running costs in the bank and are actually probably over trading. And so I think the moment the rhetoric of the sort of propagandists gets ahead of, or too far ahead of, what's actually going on the ground, that's when you have a real problem. You know, the issue for me with the social enterprise, capital S, capital E, was this obsession with profit distribution, which I kind of understand. But it was like me and Jeremy Nichols were the only people lobbying the government around the turn of the century when the first social enterprise government strategy came out. And we were saying, please don't make profit distribution the cornerstone. Make it about the impact and reward and encourage people to get involved in tackling social issues through their business through the tax system rather than a particular non-profit model. Because as soon as that happened, this is the economy, you know, as soon as that, then you're saying these are the social enterprises.
It's tiny. You make it very small, don't you?
You make it very small, and then you shut down conversation with the rest of the world of entrepreneurship and family-owned businesses and all the rest of it. And that's what's happened, I think. There hasn't been the big revolutionary breakthrough. And in my view, capitalism is and the red and tooth and claw is difficult to overthrow. Yes. But it hasn't helped that, you know, these are social enterprises. So what are the rest of the economy? Anti-social enterprises?
No, absolutely, 100%. You're almost, not only are you identifying the social enterprises as a small segment, but in a way you're indirectly sending a message to the others that they are kind of like the bad guys, like if they're not part of that group. So what are we doing to attract them and encourage them rather than sort of separate them, if you like?
Yeah. And one of the things that encourage me is that, you know, there are all sorts of entrepreneurs and business people out there, family businesses, you know, startups, purpose-driven businesses, some of them calling themselves B Corps, who have never heard of social enterprise, capital S, capital E.
And that
doesn't matter. They are getting on with developing products and services which have a strong social purpose about them.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have what I guess, you know, the social enterprise SE UK has, a kind of vision of a structural transformation of the economy and of capitalism. Certainly a lot of them don't have that. But in terms of creating social capital through competitive businesses, there's loads of amazing stuff going on.
And there's loads of them doing it anyway. Like they're just carrying cracking on with it. And I think it's interesting, having been around social enterprise and now being a B Corp, whilst I see great value in both of them, you're right. You can, if you're too inward looking, you can sort of think that it's the only way, or you know, or it's the main way. Whereas actually, if you really broaden out your vision, you realize it takes all sorts. It takes all kinds of movements and organizations and people to shift the.
And it's interesting when you look at the shortlists for the Social Enterprise Awards every year, and including this year. I mean, I'm sure they're all doing great work. You know, I'm not criticizing them on that basis at all. But how many of them are real businesses in the way that, you know, mainstream economy would understand a business to be? And if you could, and I think this is a, you know, a good sort of yardstick, if you could invest in them, would you? Do you really think
it's a very good measurement?
Would you put your own money into that particular organization in the belief that it will grow and become profitable and generate enough cash for you to make a return on that? I often think that's a really good, as something I use if I'm confronted with something. I go, well, would I, you know, put my money into that organization? Now, sometimes, you know, no, I wouldn't, but because it's doing great work anyway.
Yeah.
But if it's positioning itself as a business and is being held up as an alternative to those horrible people in the private sector.
Ideally, then, it should be doing better. In an ideal world, it should be doing better than a normal business.
And I think it is also, you know, balls, that it's rhetoric about it's your social purpose makes it easier for you to make profit. I just don't think that's
true. I know,
true.
I agree. I think
it's not true.
Yeah.
At the level of costs, at the level of culture, at the level of opportunity costs and all of that. It's not a, I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
No.
But, you know, think about FRC and lots of the organizations that I've been involved in over time, like 15, you know, there were extra costs in there of staffing, you know, recruiting all of these young people. And yes, that would attract some customers who wouldn't otherwise wouldn't have come to London to go. But I get that. But at the big picture was it was there were costs loaded in there that were social costs of having those young people join us, and it was bloody harder than just running a straightforward fancy restaurant.
Of course,
you know. Yeah. And the hard bit was, and this was the same effort, and all of the businesses that I've been involved in like that, and in the mentoring I do now of some of them, and I sit on the board of a couple. Excuse me. Is not so much the money, or that's always tricky. It's getting the people who are able to, what I used to say, you know, are trilingual, can speak business, can speak money, and can speak impact. And particularly getting those at a leadership level was really hard in Liverpool in those days because, you know, we were in a city that was declining. We couldn't pay what you might have been able to pay in London or New York or places like that. That's the hard bit. My failures have been, and there have been many, have been around not being able to get the right team of people together to do it. Sometimes by bad judgment, but often because it's just bloody hard to do that. Maybe, I don't know if it's easier today, it's more acceptable or more understood, but it was certainly hard in those days.
Well, they often say, I think you have to be quite up and running and quite established, but like a lot of businesses that I've heard talk, they said that when they were finally able to afford to hire in really good people who'd done it at a high level, it changed the game. But the thing is if you brought those people in too early when it wasn't as established, they probably would fail too, because they're not probably not used to working in organizations that are sort of scrappy and messy and just finding their way. So it's kind of a, you know, it's a timing thing as well, isn't it?
It is a timing thing, you know, and talent acquisition is a big issue in all organizations of any, whatever the business model is. But when you're trying to simultaneously run a successful business commercially and have a declared social impact, then getting those people is tricky, because it is bloody tricky. The trade-offs and how to make them and when to make them and all of that are hard. Yeah, that was always my struggle and continues to be a struggle in any purpose-driven business that I have any contact with.
Yeah, definitely. On storytelling, one of the characteristics of good storytelling is kind of a good name, something memorable, you know, a little different. I mean, even I was just looking at your newsletter, Peace, Love and Profit, is all thriller, no filler. So little catchy things like that are helpful. But what have you learned in your time around storytelling? Maybe you can point to a campaign that you liked or that worked well, or one that didn't work well, or maybe it's just more broadly what your thoughts are around the importance of it, and also what, how does it work well?
I think it's really important. I spend a lot of time with the boards I'm on, the people I mentor and so on, where we talk about what's the story, who's telling it, you know, because if you don't tell it, someone else is going to tell it. The easy one to answer about campaigns and stories that really stick, maybe it's in my mind because I'm actually talking to him later on, but Martin Neri, who used to run Barnardo's, he did some great stuff when he was there. And there's a video that they put out, which they couldn't broadcast because it had the phrase fuck off in it a lot. And it's a child. So you see from behind a social worker who you assume is someone from Barnardo's. And there's a child looking at you sitting in a sort of empty room on a chair. And you hear the voice of the social worker saying, so what did you do when you were, you know, with your foster parents? I told them to fuck off, says the kid. Yeah, so what did you do when, you know, the social workers came? I told them to fuck off. And what did you do when you first met Barnardo's? I told them to fuck off. And there was a kind of pause. And then the kid goes, and they didn't fuck off. And that was it.
Powerful. Powerful.
Really powerful. I mean, brilliant acting by this child. It's absolutely fantastic. So, and I remember Martin showing that. And I think it was in 2011. And I remember him showing it as an example of very simple, powerful comms, which doesn't turn the child into a pathetic victim or appeal to our condescension about this kid or shy
or
away
pity.
From, or pity or shy away from the fact that this is a difficult kid, you know? Really, really good. So as a sort of example of a really punchy, powerful, memorable piece of storytelling, I think I've never come across one better than that, really. And I would encourage your listeners to sort of just write fuck off Bernardo's in Google and you'll find it.
Yeah.
So that, but the power of storytelling is really important. It's been very important in my life, and I'm not entirely sure where it comes from in me, but in latter years, I've been really mindful about being the author of my own story / reputation. So when I left, and this became very acute when I left working with Jamie Oliver, because, you know, working for a very famous, a very high profile business, everybody wanted us, flying all over the world, all of that. When I left that and I went to work with the NGS at Wavelength, completely understandably, you know, Adrian wanted to introduce me as, oh, this is Liam, he used to work with Jamie Oliver, because that would give me credibility and it would give our offering credibility. And after a couple of months, I was like, you know, I don't want to be seen as the thing that people remember me for, as the guy who used to work with Jamie Oliver. So I said, look, we'll do this for 6 months. You can do this for 6 months. And what we say to people, what's in our comms, PR stuff. But after that, we stop. And we don't say that. And that worked really well. And then when I left Wavelength, I didn't want to be seen as the guy who sort of career's over kind of thing. You know, he's done it. He had his business and he's now left his business. So that's when I started doing the newsletter, which now is sort of morphed into Peace, Love and Profit on Substack. I did quite a lot of podcasting, did a lot of interviews like this deliberately. And so it was very clear that I'm moving into a new phase in my life where I haven't got a full-time job, as it were, but I'm doing lots of different tours of duty with different things around being in this part of my life now. And one of the things I talk about a lot is, I can't remember the guy's name now, but he was a speaker at Wavelength, and he talked about the four parts of life: learning, proving, enabling, and living. And they map on reasonably well to the sort of human, you know, three score years and 10 or whatever it is. That, you know, first section is learning, you know, like going to school, going to college if you go. Then you're into proving, you know, developing your career, building your business, becoming the CEO, exiting or whatever it is. And that was my Jamie in Wavelength time. That was the proving time. Now I very, very deliberately saw myself and still do as in the sort of enabling part of my career. And that's where the mentoring, the impact investing, the sitting on other people's boards is all part of that, and trying to, you know, to the degree that it's helpful, bringing my experience and my connections and networks to people to help them go further, faster, and make their own mistakes and not mistakes that were made by, you know, people like me. And at some point, you know, I'll be in the giving stage where just doing pro bono stuff and might be very local or whatever. I think it's very important that any person thinks about what the time of life that they're in and what is the story they want to tell about where they're at and what they're doing.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's a really good point. And as you say, you need to be intentional about it, because it's easy to just drift along often and sort of suddenly realize one day that you're not exactly where you, you know, you're not sure where you are in the story.
Yeah, completely, completely. Or someone else writes it for you. You know, the guy who used to be the CEO with Jamie Oliver, the guy who used to be one of the founders of Wavelength. Those are all really important part of my story, which I'm very grateful for, but they're not the whole story. And, you know, the story continues to be written. Some of it will be written by other people in the way that they perceive me, talk about me, you know, good and bad. But I'm determined that that story will be led by, you know, the person trying to live it, me.
Whose story it is. Yeah. What about bad campaigns? Or, you know, you might have a specific one, or just more broadly, when does storytelling sometimes miss the mark, or or maybe not be aware of the environment they're in, or
I think it's just when it's a story and it's not true. There's no, you know, authenticity is a word that's chucked around a lot, isn't it? And I'm not a huge fan of, you know, I'm not a fan of authentic leadership, given that I have no idea what it means. But I think people can see through bullshit if they come at it with their eyes open. And so, was it that Coke advert?
Pepsi?
Or was it Pepsi, where there's a sort of all of these beautiful looking people are on some demo?
Was it something to do with Black Lives Matter or something?
I think it was something. It was some one of those pathetic attempts by the corporate world to pretend they gave a shit about any of that stuff. I can think of a very specific level. I remember, and this is in the public domain, so I can talk about it. The CEO of Centrica, just after Black Lives Matter, of Centrica, being on LinkedIn, being videoed, and I may be getting the personalities mixed up here, but he had a John Lennon poster behind him, and he had it wasn't a Che Guevara t-shirt, it wasn't that, it was Maya Angelou or something. And he's talking, no, he was quoting Maya Angelou, and he had a John Lennon poster, something like that. And it was like, you know, it's like transparent bullshit. You know, obviously scripted.
You know, and someone had chosen those props and
someone
everything.
Someone said, look, you've got to get out there. You know, we've got some of our staff are kicking off and you've got to say something. So, I've got a John Lennon t-shirt. I mean, again, it might not be that it was exactly like that.
But we get the idea. But yeah, I understand exactly.
It was
exactly.
just so crashingly naff and pointless. And also, you know, and you see this a lot with a lot of corporate people around the whole trans, LGBT, et cetera, story, coming on and saying things which, kind of, well, whether they believe them or not, a lot of the people that work in their company don't.
Yeah.
But here they are articulating a particular line on this. And it's, I think it's just utterly, crashingly counterproductive. Mm. But the Pepsi one,
and there's like back sunlight coming through.
And they're all gorgeous and they're all, everyone looks like a model and all that. And then there's a line of coppers. And then this young woman comes up with a Pepsi and, you know, it's like,
And she gives it to one of them, I think.
She gives it to one of them, the
black guy, I think, or whatever.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, you know, compared the ad agent to all sitting there going, right, black person, tick. Gay looking guy, tick. Hang on, we haven't got enough women. Can we get some more women? More women. Walk over to the copper who's really good looking and not overweight and beautiful. And of course it got pulled very quickly because rightly it was ridiculed like that. So I think it's, if you're trying to tell a story of anything, it's not coming from, realness or truth. And all you're trying to do is sell Pepsi and or make yourself think that's how you align with a particular part of the zeitgeist. Don't do it.
Yes.
Don't do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's part of a broader thing, which I feel like is a disservice, I suppose, to the genuine efforts to make meaningful change. Is that I would wonder what your thoughts are. Like the left, typically, I would lean left. But you find that now, I don't like it personally, and I'm sure a lot of other people don't like it, where it's almost like you're being told what you have to think.
Oh, yeah.
If you're a lefty, and it's prescriptive, and it's like, and so I feel like there's a lot of pushback now. So even good intentions to make positive changes kind of backfiring because people feel they're sort of being forced to think certain things.
Well, I think, I think that's absolutely right. And I think the absolute sort of peak of this is the, the Stonewall no debate strategy that they took. Whatever your view is on gender and trans people and the binariness of of sex. Put that to one side. If you're trying to affect social change in a way that Stonewall clearly were, and your approach is, we don't debate this. Here are the answers, and we don't debate those. That is such a counterproductive strategy. And we've seen it. We've seen what has happened. Because if you say there's no debate, and anyone who does want to debate is a bigot or a, whatever it might be, you just end up going backwards with the campaign that you want. If you don't engage people, particularly those who disagree with you or don't understand or might have a very strongly held alternative point of view, you're going to be in real trouble.
And unfortunately, what happens is that the people who maybe do have, let's say, possible dangerous opinions on those things are also out there saying their thing. And if you're in the middle, like your normal average person, and you're feeling this cognitive dissonance that you want me to agree with something that I may not agree with exactly, I feel alienated from you. And then chances are some of those people will get drawn to the slightly more extremist views of the other side.
Yeah,
it's really difficult. I think in the long term, it's damaging for the progress.
Totally. And I think that, you know, if you're in the business of changing hearts and minds with a view to changing legislation, then if you don't engage the hearts and minds of those who are skeptical or disagree with you, you turn them into enemies. And if you end up in a sort of polarized debate, then bad actors are going to come in on either side of that. And then, you know, the majority go, it's too difficult for me to get involved with. The very thing that you were going for, whatever that social change thing might be, whether it's tolerance for particularly minority groups or it's change in legislation.
Better understanding.
Whatever it is. You undermine yourself and you won't get to your goals. So at Wavelength, we were never doctrinaire about any of the sort of stuff that we stood on. We kind of would encourage a lot of debate and discussion, and we would be provocative in order to stimulate some debate, but to say, like, here are the questions and here are the answers, and all you need to do is learn them. It's a really silly way of approaching stuff. We've got to be a lot more grown up and nuanced in the stories we tell and how we engage with audiences, particularly those who don't agree with us. On storytelling, you don't just want to be the person that's seen as the stone thrower or the naysayer, but I think we all have a responsibility, particularly those with some sort of public platform, to use it in the interests of those who don't have that platform or voice or too scared to say it because their business is too nascent or, they're still learning. But I think it is entirely possible to be optimistic and upbeat and joyful and also brutally honest about things.
You
need both. And I think, always being on guard for complacency is really, really important. I learned that. I had a fantastic chair in Liverpool called Graham Morris, who, there's a good story here. Do you want to hear my good story about Graham
Morris? Go for it, please, yeah.
So when I took over FRC in 97, I can't remember, something like that, I had a lovely man who was the chair, but he was the wrong man to be the chair with me as the CEO. And it was all coming to a head. And I was going to go to the board meeting and say, it's him or me, And anyway, he then resigned, whole other story. Yeah. So I was hunting for a new chair. And Sarah Williams, she said, I heard this guy speak today at a press conference. He's called Graham Morris, a Scouser. And he's just stepped down in a blaze of publicity as the CEO of Bentley and Rolls-Royce cars.
Wow.
And he had stepped down because he believes that he'd been given bad information by, I think it was BMW that bought them, wasn't it? And he had said, I'm never going to lie to the, tell an untruth to the staff. And I have, because I was badly briefed by the owner. And so he resigned. And he was asked at this press conference, well, what are you going to do now? And he said, I want to bring the Jensen motor car back into production, and I want to do some good work in Liverpool. And so I thought, ooh, he sounds good. And so I wrote to him, Graham Morris, Rolls-Royce crew, and said, look, I'm looking for a new chair. We're great. You know, come and have a look and be my chair. And this is the old days where you wrote, you probably don't remember this, you wrote and you put a stamp on it and you sent it off.
Oh, the sealed one. Yeah.
Yeah, you remember that?
The one you wax, with the wax, yeah. That's it. Yeah.
And then someone on a horse would gallop off and take it. And then the next day, there was a phone call, and my PA at the time, Joan, said, there's Graham Morris on the phone. And at the time, I used to play football with a guy called Graham Morris and to the pub with him. I remember taking the phone and going, what are you fucking calling me at work for? And he goes, you wrote to me. I said, I didn't write to you. What do you mean I wrote to you?
Oh, no.
That Graham Morris. So he had a good laugh about that because, as I would discover, he's got a fantastic sense of humour. And so he came up and in his fantastic, Rolls-Royce sports car. And I remember thinking as he pulled up, I've made a bit of a mistake here. But he got out and he went and he disappeared for like 2 hours onto the shop floor and just talked. Oh, wow. Really, Scouse boy, and got on really, really well with everyone. Anyway, he became my chair. But he would always say, the thing we have to look out for is complacency. So I've been involved in so many businesses where you just get complacent and you think you're winning and you always will. And then, and I remember him talking about costs. He says, it's always easy to spend more money. He says, it's like putting a weight on. You kind of look at yourself in the mirror and go, a bit chubbier there. No, but I look pretty good actually. And, and then eventually you find yourself, you have a heart attack because you're overweight and you die. Because the same way with businesses is like you take on here and do we really need that job? Okay, come on. Mm. And then blah, 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 blah. And then you suddenly find that then you have a crisis and you're in real trouble. Yeah. And so, having that sort of appropriate level of paranoia about the organization and its future is something that I learned from him. Mm. And also how to run great board meetings. He was absolutely fabulous at that. And he knew so much more about business than I did. Like his little finger, he knew more than I would ever know, having been on the board of Ford and Audi and things like this, but never patronizing, never condescending, always wanting to make sure that the chair CEO thing worked really, really well for both of us, but more importantly, in the interests of the purpose of the company. So look out for complacency.
Yeah, nice one. What are your closing thoughts to share with us before we leave on the topic of storytelling for social impact?
The last book I wrote, I ended it with a story about Muhammad Yunus. I had the great privilege of running Yunus's solidarity campaign, myself and someone in France and someone in Washington. And when he picked up the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of Grameen, he gave a fantastic speech, really, really great speech, which I encourage everyone to read. He is a fantastic storyteller, Yunus. Mm. I mean, he really is. His thing about poverty, what's your mission? My mission is to put poverty in a museum. And in the future, we will visit museums about poverty and marvel that in the same way that we go to a Holocaust museum and go, how could that have been that 6 million Jews were murdered like that? We will go to poverty museum. But how could it be that in a world of plenty, we allowed this to happen? Just great images and stories. And he talked about his vision for a world free of poverty and injustice and so on. And, I end that book by saying, what if you had to speak to that Nobel Prize audience? What would your story be about your ambition of purpose and social change in the world? And that would be my closing remarks is always be thinking about what that story might be. And at the heart, a lot of the mentoring I do is about storytelling with the founders that I work with, is what is the story you want your investors to hear, your customers to hear, and your staff to hear that is true and challenging and inspiring. And it's something that changes over time. but you have to be very mindful of it and return to that narrative because it might need revision.
Amazing. That's powerful, actually. As you were saying, I'm one of the listeners as well as being the host here, and I'm thinking, yeah, gosh, we need to think about that.
Yeah. Well, I'll leave you with that. I'll leave you with that tingle.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us, Liam.
It's a total pleasure. And I look forward to seeing the edited version of this. And make me look good.
Yeah, no problem.
All right.
Thanks, man.
See ya. Bye.
Thank you so much for making it to the end. Really appreciate it. Do make sure to subscribe. Tell a friend. You know, we put a lot of energy and time into these podcasts, and we'd love, if you're enjoying them, that you share them with a friend as well who you think might just enjoy them or benefit from listening to some of the stuff that we're sharing. And if you have the time, please do leave us a review or just send us a message. It's great to hear what you're thinking and really encouraging. We'll have a next episode for you on the first Sunday of next month. In the meantime, thanks for listening and have a great month.